From Studio F in the Feibusch Media World Domination Headquarters, this is the Feibusch Media Podcast, which may actually have a name. For now, at least, we're going to call it Top of the Tower. Our thanks to friend and WXXI colleague Juan Vasquez for coming up with that particular moniker. I'm Scott Feibusch, and this is Episode 1, our first official episode, actually in the studio, without background noise from being in the car like we were in last week's episode. So this is Episode 1 for July 19th, 2017. Welcome in. Hope you enjoy being with us. We always welcome your comments via Facebook, via Twitter, on the website, email, shout it at us, whatever is convenient for you. We'd love to hear about it. A reminder, first of all, as we launch into this week's episode, that we are just about into the big translator window opening. We talked about this in some detail last week, but to recap for you again this week, here's what's happening. Next Wednesday, the 26th of August, the FCC will open the floodgates for applicants who did not get translators in last year's 250-mile translator move window and who would like to try to put a new translator on the air for their AM station. There are a lot of qualifications here. In addition to not having participated in last year's window, you also have to be the licensee or the tentative purchaser of a Class C or a Class D AM station. And of course, you have to have a frequency where you can put this translator. Now, you are well aware, probably, if you're listening to this podcast, that through Feibusch Media, I provide these services to prospective broadcasters. And so it's been a busy week for me working with some of our clients here at Feibusch Media to try to figure out, okay, where can we squeeze a translator into any given community? It's been tough in places where you absolutely would not imagine. I'm not going to tip my hand as to what clients are working on, but there are communities where I would have thought that there would have been room to put a translator, where it turns out to be a lot harder than I ever imagined. Doesn't mean we couldn't find a frequency, but it was more challenging than we would have thought. A few more interesting things about this window as we get closer to it. One of the differences between this and last year's translator window, in last year's translator window, you had to go in as soon as the filing window was open with a complete technical application. So if you are preparing these Form 349 translator applications, these include things like the various contour maps that show that you are protecting other stations on the same frequency and on first, second, and third adjacent frequencies, the maps that show that your proposed translator fits within the FCC rules for where an AM translator can go. And of course, we know that's changed a little bit just within the last few months, where the FCC now allows you to put a translator anywhere within a circle that's described by the larger of a 25-mile radius around your AM or your AM station's 2 millivolt per meter contour. If you're out in the upper Midwest, those 2 millivolt contours can be absolutely enormous. You could have a station in, let's say, Yankton, South Dakota, that could probably qualify for a translator 60 miles away in Sioux Falls. That used to be against the FCC rules. It isn't anymore, which means there are some neat opportunities now for some AM broadcasters to do things with some of these facilities. So that's some of what we're working with. We will tell you Feibusch Media is one of the sponsors of this week's edition of Top of the Tower, and there is still some room available on our dance card here. So if you think that you are qualified to do a translator and you want one for your AM station or for an AM station that you're in the process of buying, reach out to us right away. We'd love to hear from you. Feibuschmedia.com/translator is where you'll find all of that information. So we said that you don't have to file all of that technical information this time around. The only thing the FCC wants to see this time around is what frequency you want to be on. They want to see what translator location you're proposing. And they want to see if your entity qualifies to participate down the road in an auction. Why an auction? You can blame Congress for this one. Congress, when it changed some of the rules for broadcasting about 20 years ago, specified that any new facilities that are given out have to go through an auction process now. Doesn't mean that everybody who applies for a translator and gets one in this window is actually going to have to go to auction. Once they go through this initial list of frequencies and locations that have been proposed, they will go through and say, okay, these applications don't conflict with any other applications. They are considered what's called singletons, and they can therefore proceed to the next phase of the application process. We'll get to that in a second. There will be another group where they'll say, you know what, there is a potential conflict here. You applied for 98.9 in this location. Somebody else applied for 98.7 over in this location. You're going to have a chance to work that out first and figure out if one of you can shift to another available channel, if you're lucky enough to have one, if you can change transmitter locations or powers or directional patterns or what have you, and try to make that translator squeeze in there without becoming mutually exclusive, MX, to anybody else. But if you can't resolve it, if you are part of a dreaded MX group, that is the point where you will then have to proceed to auction. I don't think realistically that there are going to be very many auction scenarios going on here. I think the FCC knows that most of those that would happen in large markets, there just aren't enough channels available. And so a lot of people probably are going to just back away from applying knowing that it's not there or might decline to participate in an auction. If something does go to auction, at that point, we're probably another few months out in this process, probably getting close to the end of 2016. And it'll be interesting to see what people are willing to pay for some of these. In some larger markets, we have seen existing translators sell for prices that are well into the millions of dollars. Will somebody pay that at auction to bid somebody out of getting a translator frequency? That remains to be seen. If a station is lucky enough to get a singleton, however, things get much easier, because at that point, you come back to me or whoever your consultant is, and you say, okay, I'm sitting on a singleton here. What do I do next? Well, the answer actually turns out to be pretty easy. You fill out the rest of that Form 349 with all the circles and the arrows and all the technical details that you pay somebody like me to do for you. It gets filed. If it is technically acceptable, and this is actually the first point at which the FCC is going to sit down and say, hey, wait a minute, does this conflict with anything that already exists? If you bring them something that's technically acceptable, you're good to go. It gets granted. It probably, if prior experience is any guide, gets granted pretty quickly. You get it built. You get on the air with an FM translator. There are a lot of questions that get asked, and you'll probably see some in the comments here, and we want to hear your feedback about this, about what good these are actually doing to AM operations. Is this actually something that is, quote, revitalizing AM? That's not necessarily revitalizing the AM band. I think most of us agree. I certainly have said all along, it's not really revitalization for AM as a medium. What it is revitalization for AM broadcasters as a business model. And there are places that you can definitely point to, and we'll talk about them more in upcoming editions of this podcast, of where these translators are providing benefit for AM stations, allowing them to put themselves in front of listeners on the FM dial, where most of these listeners are these days, and to really make something that helps serve local communities well into the 21st century. So that's the little translator pitch for this week. Keep an eye out. We will certainly be covering over on Northeast Radio Watch all of the machinations that the FCC goes through as these filings go through. We'll have a comprehensive list on our site, and you can also look on radioinsight.com, our partner site, to see who's getting granted, where they're getting granted, or at least who's applying and where they're applying. You can kind of figure out singletons and MX groups as soon as you start seeing these applications. And it'll all, of course, close shut again on August 2nd. One other quick note before we move on is that as of today, as of actually 12:01 this morning, if you're listening to this on the day we posted on Wednesday the 19th, the FCC has closed off temporarily any applications for minor changes to existing FM translators, boosters, or low-power FM stations. It means that there was a sudden rush earlier this week of applications to upgrade and move FM translators around to try to get things in before this window slammed shut. Now that it's shut, we have essentially a stable database for all of us consultants to work from that says, okay, here's who's out here, here's what they're doing, and so here's what you have to protect as you're making these filings that are going into the window. So that's where we are right now with that. There will, of course, be more action on FM translators as we come out of the filing freeze. If people see, hey, there's still this frequency available that nobody grabbed, you may see some moves around as people try to upgrade what they have. Again, this is part of our sponsorship from Fibush Media. We are very happy to provide these services to the broadcasting community. If you have an AM station and you're interested in a translator, it's not too late yet, but boy, it's getting too late quickly. Reach out to us, fibushmedia.com/translator. Back in a second.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to the Much More Music Station.
CKLW, the Motor City.
A little audio there from the big CKLW reunion that took place over the weekend. How can you not love CKLW, right? Great radio station. Wonderful honor that they put together celebrating the 50th anniversary of the start of the Top 40 format that was so legendary, not just in Detroit and Windsor, but all over the Great Lakes and beyond, anywhere that 50,000-watt signal came in, anywhere that that you could hear the jocks, that you could hear the music, that you could hear the news. Byron McGregor and the news crew there doing those wonderful newscasts. His widow, Joanne Shuddy McGregor, is still active in Detroit radio. I was up there in January and turned on the all-news station, WWJ, and there she was doing traffic even now. And I had to explain to everybody who was in the car with me the significance of hearing her on the air even now. It was cool. So there's a little sound from that. We will try whenever we can here to feature some events like that that are in the news. But for this segment of the Top of the Tower podcast, we are going to turn our attention for a little bit over to the TV side of things and start talking about a topic that I expect we will be revisiting here fairly often in the months and weeks to come, and that is this digital TV repack. This is complicated stuff. I fully expect that we'll be getting some experts here with us on the podcast to try to explain it a little bit better and to try to tease out some of the nuances. What I want to focus on this week in particular is something that is not especially well understood as part of this whole process, and that's this concept of spectrum sharing. And we are starting to see these sharing agreements coming out now all of a sudden. I'm going to be reporting on them some more next week in Northeast Radio Watch, digging into some of the ones that are happening in the region that we cover every Monday on the column on fivebush.com. But here's the gist of what's happening here. You know, if you've been following this at all, that the FCC is now very deep into this process by which they are going to cut down the amount of UHF spectrum that is used by broadcast television in the U.S. Right now, we go all the way up to channel 51 in UHF, up into the 600 megahertz realm there, up actually right up to 700 megahertz. What's going to happen over the next allegedly 39 months, although that schedule is still very much subject to change, is that anybody who is now operating above channel 36, so everything from channels 38 to 51, 37, of course, is reserved for radio astronomy, everything that now operates from 38 to 51 has to be relocated somewhere lower down into the TV dial. In the process, of course, you get to take advantage of some of the holes that were created when all the analog TV stations went away in 2009, or at least the analog full-power stations. So you have lots of room, or at least some room in markets, to pack stations a little closer together to make the spacing make a little bit more sense, and so on. One of the ways, of course, in which the FCC did this was to create this complicated forward and reverse auction system. Forward, in that you have bidders such as T-Mobile, such as Microsoft and Google, who would like pieces of this newly freed up 600 megahertz spectrum, saying, okay, here's what we're willing to pay for it and how much we're willing to pay for. And reverse, in that you have TV station owners saying, here is the least that we're willing to accept in order to vacate our channels or to move from UHF down to VHF, or to agree to share channels with somebody. So here's where it continues to get interesting, because in a lot of these cases, you saw the big headlines a few weeks ago when the first pieces of this became public of the FCC auction results, where it said, okay, this and such station has agreed to give up its spectrum. And the other piece of that is that they don't necessarily give up the license. The license is still there. What does a broadcast TV license mean in 2017 or 2020? It means, most importantly, that when you are dealing with cable or satellite companies, that you get the chance to either invoke must carry and say, hi, we are a TV station that exists in the DMA that your system covers, therefore you must carry us on your system. Or that says, hi, we're a TV station that exists in your market, therefore we get to negotiate with you to decide whether or not you're going to pay us money for the privilege of carrying what is presumably the desirable programming that's on our signal. So if this still exists, but you don't have any underlying spectrum to go with your station, what happens next are these channel sharing agreements. And these are getting interesting. There are some pieces here that I think, frankly, not too many people, even keen observers of the broadcast industry, fully appreciated going into this process. So here are some of the interesting things that this is turning out to encompass. What you're seeing now are station groups that in some cases are positioning themselves as potential hosts for displaced stations. So even if a station has given up its spectrum, it still has a license. It needs a place to broadcast. And a few canny broadcasters are looking now and saying, you know what, there's money to be made in becoming a host entity for some of these licenses that don't otherwise have a place to broadcast from. Univision in particular seems to be kind of at the front of this, and so we are seeing them in certain markets make their stations available and sign these agreements either to host another station or in some cases even to buy out stations that had planned to be hosted on their signals. We saw that happen in the Boston market, where Univision owns WUTF, which if you go way back is the old V66, WVJV. It's got a big UHF signal over most of Boston from a tower in Hudson, Mass. And it is making some of its spectrum available through a sharing agreement to what was WBIN in New Hampshire. This is the old WNDS-TV of Al Caprillion fame. Bill Binney bought it. Bill Binney then went and sold the spectrum for a huge amount of money and now has sold what's left of the license of WBIN over to Univision, which will now have the second license that it hosts on WUTF in the Boston market. In the Philadelphia market, they're doing the same thing. Univision owns WUVP, channel 65. The RF channel, I believe, is 29, coming from closer to Philadelphia. They have done a deal now with what's left of WMGM-TV over in the Atlantic City market. Never covered all of Philadelphia before. It just had a small signal that was mostly coastal New Jersey. All of a sudden, what's left of WMGM, which has basically been running infomercials under its current ownership, has signed this channel sharing deal. They will now become what's called a sharee with WUVP. And so their license will be carried on WUVP's spectrum and will show up for viewers around Philadelphia. For viewers, in theory, this doesn't change a thing. All you have to do is rescan your channel. Just about every DTV tuner that's out there is capable of comprehending that you may have two signals that are sharing an RF channel that have different primary channel numbers. So you might have 65.1 for the Univision programming from WUVP, and that same signal might also be carrying 28.whatever from their low-power station that's also relocating, and 40.whatever from WMGM. It creates the possibility of these new sort of, call them phantom stations, that will be able to operate at fairly high power, in theory covering more of a market maybe than they did before, and more spectrum efficient too. That's actually perhaps something to like about all of this. There could be some positives in this. We shall see how that goes going forward. One other note about this whole phantom station thing, if that sounds kind of familiar to you, and if you're an old-time broadcast historian, especially one who's paid attention to Canada, we've seen exactly the same thing happen before. If you go all the way back to the late 1920s and early 1930s in Canada, you had transmitters that were put on the air in most major cities by one or the other or both of Canada's major railways, either CN or Canadian Pacific Railways. And they put these transmitters on the air in most major cities. It was CNRT, for instance, in Toronto, and CNRO in Ottawa, and so on. And in some cases, they were actually hosted by transmitters of commercial stations in those cities, or vice versa. So there were entire radio stations that existed as full-fledged commercial radio stations in big cities like Toronto and even in smaller markets that had no physical transmitter reality of their own. They were actually using hours on the air from transmitters that belonged to one of the railroads to broadcast. This has been done before. The only difference back then, of course, was that you couldn't have the railroad-run programming at the same time as the commercial station programming. Now everybody can get along, or so it seems. We will again be talking to more experts about this as we go forward. It's a topic that we know there are a lot of questions on, and hopefully this can be a resource to help explain some of those, learn from some of the experts, and provide some useful information to the broadcast community. Again, you're listening to Top of the Tower. It's the podcast from Fibush Media. Some of the products that we provide you in addition to this new podcast, of course, Northeast Radio Watch comes to you week in and week out on Fibush.com every Monday. On Tower Site of the Week, every Friday on Fibush.com, you can see an interesting look at a broadcast facility somewhere around the country or maybe even around the world. We are right now midway through a recap of Omaha, Nebraska. We got to spend a bunch of time in Omaha in February, which I know it doesn't sound exciting. It's Omaha. It's February. You would have had to have been there. It was in the 60s. The sun was out. The engineers were friendly, and we got to see a ton of stuff. If you've never seen one of these classic Midwestern antenna farms where you have 3,000-foot TV towers lined up, one next to another, along a major drag, looking out over the entire market. We get to show you one of those here. Some neat studios, too, if you are into train stations that have been turned into TV studios. Stay tuned. There's one of those coming up that you've got to see to believe. That's coming up next week on Tower Side of the Week. And then TopHour.com is where we bring you audio from station IDs from around our travels. So if you ever want to hear what the top of the hour IDs sound like in, say, Omaha, well, that's the opportunity to check that out every Wednesday at TopHour.com. And, of course, Radio Insight is where you will find all the latest news on broadcast formats and sales and technical applications from coast to coast. Lance Venta keeps that updated on a daily basis on the website and all over social media, so do not miss that one also. One more note on the products that we offer. Fibush Media is, of course, the home of the Tower Site Calendar. The 2018 Tower Site Calendar is in production right now. No, I'm not going to tell you what's on the cover of it. You're going to have to wait and see. No, you can't order it just yet. That's coming very soon, though. If you're interested in advertising there, right now is the time to reach out to our business manager, Lisa Fibush. Catch her at lisa@fibush.com, and you can put yourself in front of and on the walls of lots of happy engineers enjoying what they're doing all over the country. Great opportunity there, but the window is closing for you to get in on the 2018 Tower Site Calendar, so that's coming up soon. The Top of the Tower podcast continues in just a moment, right after this.
Good morning, fam. 103.9 WDKX, Andre Marcel with Music with Texture. That's a double play of Marvin Gaye on 103.9 WDKX. I have family members up and a guest, Scott Fibush. You fam, too, also, man.
Well, thanks.
Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
With XXI, but he's also firsthand. All of you saw the show last night. Mm-hmm. And now talking to you, I hear three different stories. So, Scott, why don't we start? First of all, I'd like to thank you for bringing your kids, because that's what I'm always trying to tell people. Bring your kids to these shows so you can expose them to different types of music.
Absolutely. And I discovered one thing. I figured that my daughter, at least at some point, would have been exposed to Lakeside, right? Would have heard Fantastic Voyage. She never heard the song before.
And when she heard it, did she like it?
She did.
But Dre, wait. How about the dancers?
Well, that you have to comment.
I've come down, but I can't get up.
That's the best one. I was going to mention there's a few people. Well, I can't laugh because I've been too quick. Someone's going to have to help me up. So some people were dancing and remembering they were back in the 70s.
Yep.
And they were getting down.
Oh, my 9-year-old is out there dancing, and some woman comes over to him, just grabs his hand, and they're dancing there. And I'm looking at him, he's like, what's going on here? I think I'm having fun.
Party, Scott. That's how we party, yeah. DKX. But next time you start getting down, just put a hand up if you need a help getting up. I'll be right there.
What's that noise?
That's my credit report.
Okay, I promise you this is not going to turn into the weekly, hey, let's listen to a guest shot of Scott appearing on somebody else's radio station podcast. However, we had to play that one for you. It is the Top of the Tower podcast. Into our final section for this week for episode number one. And what you just heard there was a little bit of a completely unintentional guest appearance that I made last Saturday morning on WDKX here in Rochester. And a few quick words about WDKX. I put a few pictures of their new studios up on Facebook. You can go check those out if you're interested in taking a look at those. What they are doing at WDKX, this is just a wonderful example of what local commercial radio can still be in this day and age. WDKX has been family-owned since the day it went on the air way back in 1974. It is now in its second generation. Andre Langston, the son of the founder of the station, Andrew Langston, is the current general manager. He's also the Saturday morning Memory Lane host, and that's part of why we dropped in. And I don't think Andre would mind my saying this. Andre is a geek extraordinaire, just like pretty much any of you listening to this. And so he really prides himself not only on creating a radio station that remains locally owned and super serves the urban community in Rochester. It is consistently in the top three in the ratings. It is consistently financially successful. It consistently draws out tons of people to appear at its events and to take part in what it's doing. It consistently has people on the air from all over the community and provides real public service along with the music that it programs. But one of the other things that Andre does is he keeps those studios technically advanced too. And so we were up there on Saturday morning, not with any intention of appearing on the air, but simply because Andre wanted to show off his new studio build-out, which is a really neat thing. One of the things people noticed when I put the pictures up on Facebook over there is his use of large screens. You know, these flat screens now are so cheap to buy. You can get a nice 65 or even 70-inch display for just a few hundred dollars now. You put several of those up on the wall. You get an inexpensive controller to run them. And all of a sudden, all the things that you used to need a ton of flat-screen displays taking up console room for, you can put up on the wall instead. And all of a sudden, you have cleaner sight lines between whoever's running the board and whoever else is in the studio. You have some neat dynamic stuff that you can do with the studio walls. You can make it really video-friendly, because just about any studio that you build now, you have to expect that you're going to be doing some video for audio in there, visual radio, if you want to call that. That's another topic that we're going to be hitting in considerably more detail in the episodes to come here on Top of the Tower. But the point is, you can do a lot of things with these. So he wanted to show that off. The LED color-changing lighting that's up in the soffits, that's always neat to look at. There's so much you can do now just with lighting a radio space. Again, you may not hear it in the audio on the air, but again, just about any radio station these days is doing more than just audio out of their studios. So another topic that we'll hit, but a shout out to Andre and to all the great things that he is doing over at WDKX, and we will present his facility in more detail on a Site of the Week installment at some point to come also on FiBush.com. And we'll finish up this week with just a few other quick news hits, some items that you might have read about in Northeast Radio Watch or will be reading about in Northeast Radio Watch, a tip of the antenna, if you will, to what is, I think, a particularly outstanding class of upcoming inductees over at the Buffalo Broadcasters Association Hall of Fame. They're going to have their big ceremony coming up September 28th. And check out some of the names of the people who are finally going into the Buffalo Broadcasters Hall of Fame. Dick Green, who owns WLVL in Lockport and was the owner of WECK in Cheektowaga until recently, fine community broadcaster. Jim Pastrick, a good friend of the column, a good friend of mine who has really been a workhorse over the years on air and in production at a whole bunch of radio stations going way back to WYSL-FM back in the day. Mike Randall, who's the chief meteorologist at Channel 7, WKBW. Carl Russo, who does afternoons at 97 Rock. And Pete Weber, who now announces for the Nashville Predators, but did time in Buffalo as well. And I think this is particularly cool. I didn't mention this in the column this week, but Pete Weber got his Buffalo broadcasting start at WEBR, which, no, doesn't stand for Pete Weber, but you know what? He can claim it if he wants to. And Ray Marks is being inducted posthumously. Ray, of course, was one of the giants of Buffalo radio news. Nice to see him going in there as well. One of the note that we should make is, as we're talking about people who have left us, broadcasters who have left us, Bob Wolf was really one of the icons of broadcast sports. Started out in Washington, D.C. in 1939. Did some of the very first TV sports broadcasts for Dumont's WTTG as early as 1940 when it wasn't even WTTG yet. Went on to do the network call of Don Larson's perfect game in the 1956 World Series. Called games for the Washington Senators for many years, for the Knicks and the Rangers, and the dog show at Madison Square Garden. And had been working up until just this past winter as a commentator for News 12 Long Island. And from all accounts, a really, really good guy, too. Bob Wolf died last Saturday at 96 years old. We will have much more to talk about next week right here on Top of the Tower. We are getting ready to do some traveling, so we will not only be telling you where we're going, hopefully maybe we can do some episodes on the road and even check in with a few broadcasters on the road for special on-location episodes of the podcast as we do some traveling in the next couple of months around the broadcast landscape, getting some more material for upcoming calendars and upcoming Site of the Week segments and tophour.com. Thanks so much for being with us for this installment of Top of the Tower. Always interested in hearing your ideas and suggestions for what you'd like to know about, who you would like to hear from, and who we should be talking to right here. Thanks so much for being with us. From FiBush Media, I'm Scott FiBush.
And the hits just keep on coming.
CKLW, the Motor City.